Hello, my name is Olivia Harding, and I am the host of Folk Files, a podcast that explores the tangled history of folk songs. Every month, I choose a topic to dive into for about 20 to 30 minutes. The subject of each episode could be a song. In the case of Shady Grove, a lot of people believe that it is a later version of the English folk song Matty Groves, but it's not that simple. A general topic. The main theme that I saw while researching folk songs about birds from all over the world is that many of them include nonsense syllables meant to represent the bird songs. Or a question that I want to answer. There has never been any real question that Black people were central to the development of this musical style. So why do we still picture white men hauling on the rope when we think of sea shanties? Press play and join me on a journey through the origins of murder ballads, sea shanties, rebel songs, and other music that has withstood the test of time. Folk Files is so pleased to be the newest show to join the BGS Podcast Network. Find us at thebluegrasssituation.com or where you listen.
And my dad set a pretty good example. I mean, he ran every day, and when he couldn't run anymore, he biked. And he's on the road still, so he's 93. There's a great song, actually, my dad and Merle wrote. The line is, we'd have taken much better care of ourselves if we'd known we were going to live this long. And it's funny, but it's kind of true.
We often define artists by their output, their records, books, movies, and the times they're on stage.
But the art is made in the quiet, the struggle, and the mundane, the hours that no one sees. I'm Michaela Ann.
And I'm Aaron Schaefer-Hayes. This is The Other 22 Hours, an exploration of the creative life lived in the in-between. Today's episode features our conversation with Grammy-winning singer, songwriter, and guitar player Lucas Nelson, who won a Grammy for his collaborations with Lady Gaga on the soundtrack for A Star Is Born, on top of touring for years under his own name and with his band Promise of the Real. That band was the backing band for Neil Young for 5 years. And of course, Lucas is the son of absolute legend Willie Nelson, who, of course, Lucas has toured with him his entire life growing up on a tour bus. And I think he said that his dad first cut one of his songs that he wrote when he was 11, which is pretty wild.
So yeah, it's a different life path.
Different life path for sure. And we have a really great, honest conversation with Lucas about differentiating himself from his father and what that experience was growing up in that family and now following that same career path without riding coattails necessarily.
Yeah, and we get to talk about what that means, growing up, becoming his own person and experimenting and studying and learning about how to take care of yourself and the clarity that he's found with almost all sobriety and what it is to really fully sit in our humanness.
Yeah, it's a very grounded, honest perspective, I think, that he brings to this conversation. So please enjoy our conversation with Lucas Nelson.
I'm particularly excited to talk to you at this point in life just because of all the things I've been seeing you share publicly already. But we always like to start the hour with just a how are you doing today? And that's a how are you really question. And where are you physically and creatively?
I'm doing fantastic. I am in Maui. I just landed last night here from Texas. We had a show at the Paramount Theater the day before yesterday. And then flew in yesterday, stopped in San Francisco on a layover. So yesterday was kind of a long day, but we flew in and landed at 7:30 and got to surprise my girlfriend's mom, who didn't know we were coming home. And it was sort of a nice little Mother's Day thing. And she had 8 new puppies, but gave away 3. And so they have 5 puppies that we got to hang out and play with for an hour. Although last night we were so exhausted, we were in bed asleep by 9:30, and I woke up at 5 this morning to a beautiful landscape and beautiful view. And I have about a month-ish off now. I might have to go across the country again for a couple of days, but then come back. And then Our next show is in Rexford, Montana, which is on June 28th, I believe. And that's way up in Glacier National Park. So it's kind of hard to get to. Yeah, it's going to be really great. And that's with the Red Clay Strays. They have like a festival they do up there. And so I'm going to be up there with them. Then we go on the road. I'll be on the road with my dad for a while. So right now I've compiled about 28 songs. Right now I've got some demos of them and I'm working on a new album to do. I think I'm going to use this band, thinking about producers. So creatively, I'm in a good place too. I've been writing a lot and that's been feeling good, but I'm looking forward to this little break. I'm going to go on a sort of a nice diet of good food and healthy activities for a while.
Yeah, I get that. The reset and the detox after being out and traveling for a while.
I've been out for 2 months.
Oh, that'll do it.
We went to the gym a lot. It's just hard to get actual quality sleep when you're on the road and that affects you a lot.
And food. It's challenging to get healthy food. And I think sometimes it's really hard to understand, even on a level where your accommodations are nicer or your travel is nicer. It's just a challenging way to maintain care for yourself.
Yeah.
Physically,
I mean,
mentally.
At my level, we're still, you know, sometimes we'll still get buyouts for a show. Sometimes there'll be catering, which is hit or miss.
Mm-hmm.
But it's hard when you're somewhere in the middle of nowhere to get quality food, but you do what you can and you eat what you can. And I love finding little diners and getting good eggs and toast in the morning. And that covers breakfast usually. And then try to do like a steak or something lean for dinner. But it's hard. Yeah, it's really hard. And also you tend to eat more when you're out, I think. I don't know why, but it's really hard to sort of limit what you eat. You have to be really disciplined. And it was all we could do just to wake up and try and find a hotel gym or do something to move our bodies and go for walks and things like that. My girlfriend traveled with me this time, which is first time that I've had someone on the road with me ever like that. And that was really helpful because we kind of pushed each other to take care of each other and ourselves.
Yeah, it always blows my mind that when you're in the large swaths of the middle of this country and you spend all day driving through cornfields and soybean fields, it's still so hard to get fresh food, even though you've been driving through, like, air quotes, farmland all day.
A lot of that gets exported elsewhere.
For sure. Driving past animal feed mostly.
Yeah, exactly.
What was your evolution of learning the necessity of taking care of your body in that way? Was that a difficult thing to learn? Because I feel like a lot of us start on the road and it's like, oh, it's just kind of a free for all. And you think you can sustain that. And then it catches up with you. And it's like, oh, actually, I'm really depressed or I'm unhealthy or whatever it is.
Yeah. Well, it's easy to get that way for sure. I grew up with not really placing a lot of importance on exercise, although I was athletic when I was a kid. I was on the soccer team and the swim team. But then as a musician, the culture around music is the party culture, of course. Mm-hmm. And so I was smoking weed all the time and doing mushrooms and acid and drinking. And so that was kind of my road life, was in a van and not sleeping. Probably didn't sleep well for 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I grew up also on the road, sleeping on a bus. So I figured that I was actually sleeping well when I don't think I was. There's a lot to do with like the inner ear sensing movement and your body not actually going into REM sleep, even though it feels like you're sleeping, mm-hmm. or your body not actually getting deep sleep. You can sleep technically on a bus, but I read this book called Outlive by Dr. Peter Attia. And that book really opened my eyes, along with a friend of mine who was introduced it to me. I met a couple trainers through friends who helped me understand what the goals should be for my health and exercise and why it's so important. And reading that book showed me why it's so important just for longevity. And my dad set a pretty good example. I mean, he ran every day. And when he couldn't run anymore, he biked. And even now he does his exercise routines in between times when he's on his oxygen machine, and he's on the road still. So he's 93. I definitely have the potential genetically to live a long time. And so when I think about that, there's a great song, actually, my dad and Merle wrote, the line is, we'd have taken much better care of ourselves if we'd known we were going to live this long. And it's funny, but it's kind of true, because I see my dad now with COPD because of the smoking. And that is something that I want to avoid. Not that living to 93 itself isn't great, but I'd like to try and live to be 93 without having that added discomfort. You know, I think that I'm just trying to, we all try and improve on and learn from our parents. But he set a good example. So I try to stay healthy because I want to live a long time and feel good while I am.
I've read a good portion of that Outlive book. What's the term? He uses the term in there. He calls it like a health span versus lifespan. Yeah, is that right?
Exactly.
Like, for those that haven't read, it's like the idea that you want to remain healthy as long as possible, not just live as long as possible, which it seems like your dad and Merle had that idea already.
Yeah, I don't think they thought about it that way. But my dad sort of naturally stopped drinking a lot and just ran and got exercise and was always athletic. So that's what I think has kept him going so long, along with his genetics. But the smoking weed never stopped up until he was like 80, 89.
Whoa.
And until he literally could not anymore, or because every time he'd take a hit, it would hurt his lungs bad. So now he just does the Willie's Remedy stuff. So he never gave up the weed. For me, I don't feel like I need it anymore. I feel like my creativity is so much clearer and free-flowing without it than it is with it. The only thing about weed that really helped sometimes was if I got in a sort of a rut mentally, I could take a hit and then it would force me to let go of things or to look at things or just slow down a little bit. So there, it is a medicine and helpful for a lot of people, but I just don't really need it anymore. And so I don't really use it. And I think I feel much better now, because also it keeps the highs and lows of my moods way more balanced. Like, totally. For the most part, I feel like I can deal with things in my life so much more clearly and finally. And if I move through something or work something out mentally or psychologically, it sticks now, rather than, oh, I moved through it while I was high, but then I completely forgot what that whole thought process was and it never really stuck.
Totally.
You know?
Yeah. It's interesting about these self-medicators and the benefits that come with weed versus alcohol, but we'll turn to a lot of those things to what we think is helping us to cope when really it's a lot of times numbing. And it's fascinating to me because Aaron's completely sober. I every once in a while try to have a drink and then I'm like, I can't drink anymore. But yeah. I feel like when you get to the side of everything out of your system, the clarity that comes and the actual realization of your emotional capabilities can be pretty profound. I'm sure everybody has a different experience. But furthermore, you said your creativity flows more, but also in the world of country music and roots music, and especially in the family you're in, of, you know, Willie Nelson looms so large in this cultural presence. Even our like four-year-old, we do not push it, and our four-year-old daughter is obsessed with your dad. Like every morning, that's the record that she puts on, and that's she does her running. She runs in circles in our house to Willie, Redheaded Stranger. And
that's so
and
sweet.
His version of Georgia on my mind, because that's her name. But I'm curious if there was any detangling of identity that had to happen with the ways that it's...
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, not even just the impact of your actual creative flow, but the identity attached to partaking in those things socially, culturally.
Yeah, I mean, it just sort of always struck me that I didn't like to box myself into a specific identity ever. I'm kind of lucky in that way that I hated the idea of being only one way. I think I felt like I was identified as the creative musician, weed smoker, occasional drinker guy for a while. But before that, I identified as an athlete, as a swimmer. And that was before I even started smoking weed. And so really going back early into childhood, I think not smoking weed and not doing the substances at all really helped me to sort of look at the things that I had been running from, go back and really clearly look at why I was running from myself. There were things that happened when I was younger that caused me to either feel guilt or shame and want to try and spiritually sort of overcome those feelings. And I felt like the substances helped me get more in touch with myself spiritually. But ultimately, that became the opposite effect.
Mm.
And it sort of masked the actual work I needed to do in sobriety in order to like look at these things and let them go completely. And so that, I think, was a really important process. And once I did that and sort of just looked at them, sat with myself, forgave myself for whatever I thought I did wrong, which I realized a lot of stuff was beyond my control, I realized that, oh yeah, you're a pretty good person. And so that becomes my baseline in just the knowledge that you're like a good person. You do the best. You try and help people all the time, a lot of times to your own detriment. And the things I need to work on are setting my boundaries and making sure that I can say no without feeling guilt for saying no, and making sure that I can live the life I truly want to live. And that comes with clarity. It comes with being honest with myself. And it's hard to be honest with yourself with weed. It kind of makes all these thoughts just flood in really rapid fire into your mind and your heart and your soul. And it's hard to organize them all. Without it, each thing that comes in, I can sort of take in, process, and then move through in a much more clear and concise way. With alcohol, it was kind of an anticlimactic or not very interesting reason I stopped, was just because I was wearing this Whoop device, and every time I'd take one sip, barely a sip, or a shot of like sake or whatever at sushi, it would just kill my sleep score.
Mm.
And I was just really bummed about that.
Yeah.
Like, I really did not like the sleep not being good. I did a whole tour driving myself from show to show because I wanted to stop in hotels and sleep through the night rather than be on the bus.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I really got for a long time obsessed with making my sleep really good, because I think that was the one thing that I was really heavily indexed on, exercise and working out. And I got myself in super good shape, top shape, could run a 5:45 mile, just super fast. And then the last element of that was, okay, you're over-indexing on this fitness thing, but you're not actually getting the rest you need. So on the tours, I would drive myself everywhere, but that wasn't really sustainable either. Now I'm figuring out a balance, but the drinking was just like, no way. That just erases every piece of progress that I've made. And I didn't really find it that fun or interesting anyways. It doesn't really like help me socially. It doesn't help me mentally. It doesn't really do anything. I don't feel more comfortable when I've had a drink. I feel more comfortable when I haven't.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess I'm just one of those lucky people that feels worse when they drink. So it's sort of like,
I don't really
like it that much.
Yeah.
So I never was addicted to that. I was way more addicted to weed, because weed sort of numbed all these things and made me feel like I was going into this creative space. And I think I really liked the ups and downs and the emotional highs and lows. And once I started to find that really constant joy of clarity and peace, then that outweighed the ups and downs by a thousandfold.
Both those statements resonate with me about never really being addicted to drinking, but I definitely drank. And I'm in the same place now where like, I just don't like it. You know, there was a while where I was sober because I was like doing the on the wagon or whatever the term is. Like, I was like, no, I can't. But like now I'm very much like, I could have a drink. I just don't want to. It's not fun. Like as soon as like even a little buzz kicks in, I'm like, this kind of sucks. And now I got to wait this out. Like, you know?
Yeah. It just makes me feel a little more heavy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
A lot of times I get kind of depressed. It just doesn't really make me feel good ever. The only one that kind of does is sake for some reason. And I think it's just the environment of being in the sushi restaurant, eating good food,
mm-hmm.
and like laughing. Because a lot of times the sushi chefs, they love to drink. I've had some really fun times just getting plastered with the chef and singing songs and laughing and not even understanding each other because we don't speak the language, but just sort of connecting in that way. The one thing that's great about alcohol is it does break down barriers for men specifically. I think because men are so taught to not show affection for each other in most waking life, the booze is like the only time that you can truly bond with another man in society if you're caught up in all of that. Yep. Not me. I was raised more sensitive, so I can bond with a guy. I don't have to drink. I don't feel conflicted or threatened by that. But I think that there are a lot of men that are unable to be open truly with their guy friends because of the societal pressure to be stoic and mm-hmm. masculine in a way and not really open up or be tender with other men. And so I think alcohol is, for thousands of years, has been men's antidote to that, because when you drink, you can like, I love you, man. And, you know, you're the fucking best thing that ever happened to me. And, you know, and like, and all of that is okay under the influence socially. Mm-hmm. It's not okay to do that as a man with sobriety.
Yep.
Totally.
So I think it's the only time that men have been able to connect. They go and they get drunk on the golf course, or they go and they get drunk together or spend hours. And, you know, and so culturally, I think that's why it's so hard. It almost like people really actually do need it in the sense because they don't have the ability to do it anywhere else. So I would actually recommend, as a man, you should learn how to emotionally connect with people before you stop drinking. Because what happens is that I think a lot of people stop drinking and they feel like they've lost their whole lives because yeah. they can't connect with anyone. They can't be social. They feel boring. They feel like they got old. They feel like they're not actually nurturing the relationships they have with their friends because they don't know how to do that without it. And neither do their whole friend group.
Mm-hmm. Totally.
I think it's more important for the soul to have really good friends than it is to be healthy.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
I know a lot of people who would prefer to die alcoholic than to lose their friend groups that they have surrounding alcohol. Mm-hmm. And I understand why. I think that's a valid concern. So I think it's important to really understand how to process emotional openness and be open before you even think about stopping drinking.
That's a really great observation. It's no secret that Nashville is definitely a drinking town. And when I kind of gave up drinking, I noticed 60 to 70% of my friends disappear, to which like we've restarted relationships with probably about half those people. But there's definitely half my friend group was just like bar friends where we connected then. And now there's no common ground for us to connect on.
Yeah. I mean, weed friends too.
For sure. It's,
in a way, I lost touch with a lot of my friends because every 2 hours, they'll go out and smoke a joint. And I just mm-hmm. wouldn't do that anymore.
Hey, just a quick pause from this conversation. The Other 22 Hours is an independent production built entirely on the idea that these quiet, honest conversations matter. The best way to support our work is simply to share it. So if you can think of one person who would appreciate this show, please pass it along. And if you haven't yet, please follow our show on your listening platform of choice or subscribe to our channel on YouTube. It's a small action that makes a massive difference for us. Thanks for being here. Let's get back to our conversation. On that, using alcohol or weed as a tool to arrive in a place, whether it's vulnerability or creativity, like you're talking about with weed, you said you don't need weed for creativity. Are you getting to the same spot without it? Or have you just, are you accessing your creativity in a whole new way now?
The first song I ever wrote, I was 11 years old. And I was on the school bus, and I just put that song on my album. My dad recorded it when I was that age. He put it on his album. That song is just as good as anything I've written today. And I think that's because I was clear, and I was open to the muse, to the creativity coming through me. Mm-hmm. And you can access that clarity and that openness without weed, obviously, because I wasn't smoking weed at 10.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I didn't need it then, and I don't need it now. I never needed it really at all. What it did was helped artificially shoot me into that place immediately. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But I think now I'm in that place constantly, and I'm constantly open, and I'm never forcing it. I think with the booze and the weed, it would put you in that place, but it would also take you out of that place mm-hmm. when you're not doing it, and your brain would get trained to only want to open up based on these inputs mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. rather than just naturally just opening yourself. It's sort of like I didn't need it, but once I started doing it in order to get to this place, then the place wouldn't come unless I did it because it was trained to only come. You know what I mean? So it's kind of like a weird sort of backfiring situation. And then I had to do it, like my brain got lazy. And that's how it works, you know, when you take MDMA, for example, Your brain is flooded with serotonin because it activates those neural receptors and it deactivates the inhibitors or however it works. And your brain just gets flooded with all this serotonin and then it doesn't produce it because it says, oh, it's coming from this place. So then afterwards, you have to take your whatever your supplements are to help replenish your brain's natural serotonin creators. And so that, you know, that's the way the brain works. So over time, I just got used to smoking a joint and then an inspiration would come. That's sort of not really the way I like it. I like it now where it just comes naturally from what I'm feeling and when I'm feeling it, and I'm sober enough to recognize it now, mm-hmm. you know, even more, I think.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious about your relationship to fame and receiving recognition for creative output, growing up with a famous father, and then stepping into a similar career path, the same career path, and how aware of it you were, how it's informed your creative work, if you can speak mm-hmm. to that, especially where you're at with it now.
It definitely has opened a lot of doors for me in terms of industry connections. And I think that I was able to take full advantage of those opportunities because of how hard I worked at honing the skill set, mm-hmm. the guitar playing skill set, the performing skill set. I really approached all of that because my first dream was to be in the Olympics. And I remember how much I had to work hard when I was on the swim team and how much practice the competitive swimmers would put into their technique and everything. And so I actually took the mindset of the burgeoning training Olympic athlete vibe. And I took that and said, okay, I'm going to have to train like an Olympian in music in order to take proper advantage of these opportunities that I have available to me. And then somehow I was wise enough as a little kid to realize that this was a great career path because you can do it your whole life. It makes you happy. It makes other people happy. You don't feel like you're working because you're playing music. And so I switched from swim team to music pretty quickly and stuck with it. And I'm glad I did. I think what I see most is from other people in the media and people who don't know me or don't really aren't exposed. I've got a lot of my dad's fans that came in and sort of followed me just because of that. And so my sort of algorithm out there is different than what I feel like my artistry is. Mm-hmm. And there's no real solution to that except for just keep going. I keep working. I keep writing. And I know that I'm connecting to the people that need either spiritually or emotionally or whatever, just need to hear my music. And that gives me a sense of purpose and meaning. And I think that the people that really understand me know how much work I've put in. And that's really what matters to me, is that I look back and I can, on my deathbed, say that I worked as hard as I could. I put everything into what I do. And I maximized my potential in this life to go as far as I could with my art, which I really feel like I was given a gift for music. And I feel like I'm honoring it by sharing it in the widest possible way and bringing it to as many people as I can and living this gift. I try to honor it by putting 100% into it, even though, does it matter ultimately in the grand scheme of the universal unfolding? Yes and no, but that's not for me to really understand. I feel like I've been given this thing and I just put my head down and work hard, and however it's meant to unfold, I have to just trust.
Yeah, that's beautiful. We talk a lot on here. I'm always personally curious about the relationship of just receiving something in return for sharing our gifts and our love of music to varying degrees. I'm studying in grad school depth psychology of creativity, and I'm just curious about how it can, for some of us, taint or challenge our relationship to our creativity. And I just more and more I'm thinking all the time of how capitalism and commercialism has unfortunately made us believe that our artistic gifts that I think we're all blessed with to varying levels of access should be turned into a commodity, and what the kind of work it can take for those of us who are wanting to have our livelihood built on this, the work it takes to stay centered in exactly what you just said of I'm giving my all to my creative work and my gifts of music. And what happens in response is not ultimately in my control or up to me.
Yeah. I mean, I really am trying to make a living as well.
Yeah.
That's the thing, is that I never wanted to rest on my laurels or ride, as many people would look at me and say, oh, he's riding his father's coattails or whatever they want to think, mm-hmm. you know, but that's why I just work super hard. I go out there and I write all the time and I practice my instrument and I practice making the show as dynamic as I can with the other musicians. And I really do feel like I have a mastery of my art and my craft. And so I really enjoy the process, so that's helpful. And also, there have been a couple of great breaks that I've gotten that have helped me. Like, I got to work on the Star Is Born movie.
Mm-hmm.
I'm working on another movie project right now. I got to play with Neil Young for 5 years. And then I have enough of my own fan base now to where I can make a living for the rest of my life going and touring.
Mm-hmm.
And so whether that gets bigger or smaller over the years, I am super grateful for the return that I've gotten for just sharing my gift. I mean, I have everything that I could ever want. I have my own home separate from my family.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't have to feel like I'm sucking on the teat of the Nelson name. I think I've used the resources I have in a really good way, and I've set myself up. Now my focuses on life are the more simple things, like finding a really great relationship and nurturing that and putting 100% into that, which I'm really enjoying that process now. And also just giving everything I can to my art at the same time. I feel like finding a relationship has really helped me too, because so much of my time was spent searching for a partner or that someone. And that is really helpful for your art, but it's also distracting in its own way. I think that now I have a lot more time. I'm not putting so much time into nurturing potential relationships. I have this one relationship that I'm putting 100% into. I think that frees up a lot of my other time, especially on the road, whereas I'd be like talking to someone and maybe want to go on a date. Now I'm sitting and writing,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so actually finding a partner is really helpful, because now I have even more time to put into my art.
Mm-hmm.
Now I have time to put my art, my health, my family potentially, and that's all one could ask for. I have everything I could ever want. I'm sitting on everything I dreamed of as a kid. And I think that the rest is just icing on the cake, whatever it may come.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that point you're making on a relationship is something I've definitely thought about. I mean, Michaela and I have, I'd say, reluctantly been together for 20 years, but we met in college and neither of us thought we would be in a relationship through our 20s. And here we are in our right. 40s. And we're like, well, I guess we're still here.
We have two kids.
And we have two kids, you know, all that. But like, I've definitely thought about that, especially being on the road in a van full of dudes. And like half the guys are like on whatever dating app or whatever the equivalent was at the time, like trying to meet girls in the city we're going to. I'm like, that's a lot of energy. That's exhausting. But then also, I've never been a front person like yourself or Michaela, where it's the show is centered around me and my songs. I've always been in a supportive role, either sideman or producer or something like that. But like, putting your focus on somebody else, be it a partner or for us, like children or something, it gets you away from yourself. It takes you out of yourself, and it allows you to play somebody else in front, which I think just like frees up so much creativity and brain space to like put up a wider antenna to see what's really happening, keep things in balance.
Yeah. I mean, and you see, like, I don't know how old you are. I'm 37, but I grew up with this idea of what it meant to be. Even with my dad, I mean, seeing him being married 4 times in his early life, going and being with multiple women. And I mean, I think for the first 20 years of my life, society told me that, oh no, you're young. You got to go and sleep with as many women as you can and just be free and be happy. And you don't even have to think about settling down until you're in your 30s. That was what I grew up with. I grew up with the counterculture ideals of free love, of multiple polyamory, all of these things that sort of, I didn't grow up in a conservative household at all. Mm-hmm. So I never thought about certain values that I now value. I think a lot of conservatism comes from like religion, and I definitely have my own version of that. But I think that now I recognize certain values as just being wise and logical over the years, understanding why it's not great to just spread yourself over many people over time. Not that I regret this, but I made deep connections with a lot of people back in the day that I think I broke a lot of hearts, and I got my heart broken, and that, you know, and I think that even in being as honest as you can with people, you can still create pain when you get deep and then leave and get deep and then leave. And I was never really one of those people who could just not get deep. I was always deep. And so each one of these connections meant something to me and to that person. And then I'd just leave and go to the next town. And then me being like ADD and also an artist and present, you know, you try and keep in touch, but you don't. And so over the years, I think you just sort of leave pieces of yourself around. And so that was part of when I got sober and I just started to see, oh, wow, it wasn't bad what you were doing, but it's so much wiser to just consolidate your energy and just find somebody to love for a long time and give all of yourself to. Is just so much better for your soul. And that's just for me, obviously. Other people prefer to have that. And I think that works for them in whatever place they are in their own soul's evolution. There is no right or wrong way to live. And I'm definitely not judging people who have multiple partners, as I was one, but that's just not where I'm at now. And I think that, like you were saying, it's just so much easier and less stressful not to have all of that going on.
Michaela Ann's new album, These Are the Days, is out now on her label Georgia June Records. This self-release marks a bold new chapter for the acclaimed singer-songwriter, and the songs reflect hard-won confidence and wisdom while still holding space for vulnerability and bravery. Written during a season of profound personal transformation, These Are the Days captures the emotional landscape of a working mother learning to find meaning in everyday life.
I look at life before and after, like this record or like motherhood, and I used to feel very much like that's me back there and what happened to her. And I now feel like through the last few years, I'm like, oh, that was me, and now this is me. And liking this version better.
These Are the Days, available everywhere you listen to music. Order it now at michaelaann.com. But if you let go, don't let the worries control. Count your clovers, smell your roses, see how your own grass grows. It's a long road, and nobody knows what kind of hope you've had to chase, what kind of wind was in your face.
Well, one, being a touring musician makes it really difficult to sustain family life, home life. You're not physically present with your people. So there's all of those challenges. And then two, like you said, we have societal messages, and it doesn't really teach us that in some circles, just the depth and growth that can happen from long-term relationships when you're really facing and witnessing yourself and the other person, and they're witnessing you, and you don't run away from the darker, harder parts when it's not exciting. There's some quote out there, I think from Joni Mitchell, about when you're always starting new relationships, the excitement is that you're falling in love and knowing a new person, but also there's a sense of you're continually falling in love with yourself over and over again, because it's the excitement of someone else falling in love with you. And the difference between that and a long-term sustained relationship where you're growing with someone, and some of those days are really hard and ugly, but what can happen through that sustained time together, I think, is really where a lot of gold is, but it's not what we really celebrate culturally in society.
No, and funny enough, when I first started out, I had an 8-year relationship, and I tried to go on the road and keep that going, and it just didn't work, because at the time, she was quite a bit older and I was younger, and the things that she valued were different than me. I was just going on the road, and I never was conflicted about wanting to be with her and her only, but I was hard to keep it going while she was home and, you know, I was away. And now I'm just in this perfect place where I know exactly who I am and what I want. And I'm 37, so I think I'm young enough to where I have the rest of my life to really try and nurture this one relationship that I have. And some people might say that's late, but I don't know. I think it's just right at the right time.
That's beautiful. And that sounds like a really beautiful place to be.
Yeah. I definitely think there were a lot of soul searching traps that I got into when I was younger, where I was always looking for who I was for a long time. And I think I was looking for myself and running from myself at the same time for years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I can feel that in my journey too. When we were talking earlier about, be it mushrooms or weed or whatever, being like an invitation in, but then also being a trap.
Yeah.
The analogy I've always had is like, not that it's a specific point, but there's like a circle of awareness and presence in the paradigm that you see the world and the paradigm that you see yourself. And all of these substances can be a gateway to that, but it's very easy to blow past that, where it turns from being perception widening to being escapism. You go from moving towards this point to running away from it. It's just a theme that I've picked up from this whole conversation.
It almost feels like that you get exposed to this world that feels more like the real world than the real world in some ways.
Mm-hmm.
And so you get addicted to visiting what that world is. And like with ayahuasca, I know a lot of people who really do ayahuasca a lot. And I think it's not actually helping them be more responsible, more true to themselves. We live in a world where accountability is so important. And a lot of people, I think, are using that world to run away from the guilt they have for making decisions they made in the past. And I think that the best way past that is to just sit and actually soberly forgive yourself and make sure that you can forgive yourself and move on from those things. I mean, the only way to really get away from yourself, I think, is to help others and live your life for others and to give. And I think the best thing I ever did in my life was I had a breakup, a really bad breakup, and I went to Haiti and was working with kids there in Haiti. And it just took me completely out of myself. And I really felt that was the first introduction to that lasting sense of sober joy that I, you know, was able to find. And that joy just from giving, I think, is the antidote. If someone told me I'm in this really dark place, rather than send them to Peru for an ayahuasca ceremony, I think that I would say, oh, well, go help paint houses in Costa Rica or something. You know, I'd do something like help underprivileged kids somehow, or go and see and help a society that really has adversity versus our society, which is really, it's hilarious that we think we have adversity. Some of us do, but really comparatively, the poorest nations in this world are way worse off than we are here.
Yeah.
We're very lucky. And so I think that's a big cognitive dissonance for our society too, is like feeling like a guilt for being so privileged. And the antidote to that is, okay, well, use your privilege to help if you can.
That's a beautiful sentiment of get out of yourself and go
exactly.
Seek joy by helping others.
Yeah, and the keeping perspective of what we have or what we could not have as well, I think. Well, we like to be appreciative and aware of the time that our guests give to us, and we're so thankful that you've taken time this morning.
I enjoyed the talk. Thank you.
We end our conversations the same way, and it's kind of a choose your own adventure question. And so that's either something that someone has told you along the way, or maybe something that you've read, some idea, thought, statement that continues to resonate with you and keep your cup full and keep you inspired. Or conversely, it could be something that you wish you knew as a younger person just starting to really make a career out of your creativity.
I'm glad I experienced everything I went through, and I really am grateful for the experiences I have, even the negative ones, you know, they've shaped me. I think sometimes I wish that I hadn't got caught in the trappings of the things that society sort of pushes on you and not gotten caught up in wanting to fit in as much. Actually, funny enough, I didn't care about it as much when I was younger. And then as I got older and into the scene, into the music, I started to care more. And then in the last 7 or 8 years, I've sort of let that go. But I wish I'd have learned that earlier. But I don't have any regrets, really. I think that everything we go through sort of leads us to where we are now. And I'm really, really happy where I'm at now. So actually grateful for all the twists and turns, you know, on the road.
Yeah. Do you have like a, maybe something you read or something that somebody shared with you in conversation that resonates with you and keeps you inspired?
So many things. In dark times, I think about George Harrison's All Things Must Pass, mm-hmm. and that helps me sort of weather any storm mentally or spiritually, or even in the pandemic when, you know, we were sort of like, what is going to happen? Is life as we know it ending? And that helped me stay calm during that time. Mm-hmm. That comes from a "this too shall pass" passage in the Bible. So there's like themes, nuggets of wisdom that get sort of regurgitated and reinterpreted in culture and society. And no matter who says them, I think they still ring true.
Yeah. Beautiful.
Yeah. Well, Lucas, thank you so much for taking time. I guess it's this morning where you are, but thanks for taking time out out of your day and your first day of being back home and being off to sit and chat with us.
It was actually a very nice start. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
All right, Lucas.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
We know your time is valuable, and we're grateful you chose to spend this hour with us.
If this conversation resonated with you, know that it is just one of many. We have an archive of over 140 conversations, so if you're looking for where to go to next, you can find curated playlists by topic on our YouTube channel, or simply scroll back in this feed to find our conversations with Roseanne Cash, New York Times bestselling author Maggie Smith, Lucius, J.D. McPherson, and many others.
This show is produced by me, Aaron Schaefer-Bates, with help from Michaela Ann. All the music you hear is written, performed, and produced by me as well.
Our show is edited and mixed by Leland Holden at Podpunch, and we are proud members of the Bluegrass Situation Podcast Network.
Thanks for being here. We'll see you next time.